Hi, Dan.
Hi, Jason.
Is the garbage truck gone?
Let me check.
Ah, no.
Oh, sorry. They're just parked outside the window now.
So I think we might have mentioned this before, but when we recorded Clockwise on Wednesdays, which we did earlier today, that's when the garbage truck goes past your house. Is right. It's like 12:30, so it's right at the end of Clockwise. And sometimes it comes a little late, or we're running a little, you know, we're running closer to normal time, and we don't hear it. But then there are those days where we're running a little late, and the garbage truck is a little early. And today was a winner where you gave an entire answer with a loud garbage truck behind.
Well, and so I have to point out what's even worse than that. Is that there's a garbage truck and a recycling truck, and sometimes they're super spaced out, and one comes during the show. Today, both came by, and so I muted during the first one and thought, "Oh, I'm home free." And then the second one came by as I was giving an answer, and I realized I'm totally screwed.
Yeah, and in fact, if you listen to that episode of Clockwise, this week's episode, the one with Marlon Mann and Susie Oakes, you will hear it in the background when Dan talks toward the end of the show. Although, I will say, I denoised it quite a lot, so it's a lot less noticeable. Like, the rumble of the truck is gone, basically, but all of the, like, clunks of moving cans around and stuff are still in there. And then at the very end, there's a little teaser where we make fun of you for your garbage truck. So,
well, you can't, it's a lot hard to avoid, right? Because the rumble stuff is uniform. Therefore, yeah. It's easier to, but like them banging around, there's nothing about that.
Nothing that I can do about that.
And it's worse, obviously, in the summer when I have the windows open because my office is on the front of the house.
Sure.
And so in the winter, when they come by, you usually can't hear it.
The snow muffles the clunking exactly. At that point.
Exactly.
I have, before we go on any further, I have very important information for listeners.
Hi, listeners.
And members. Hi, listener member people. You are listener members. You're a hyphenate, all of you, because you're members, of course.
You're like priest kings.
And exactly. We're city states, except a person, more like a priest king. Philosopher kings. It's this. We are doing a Six Colors t-shirt. It is going to be out for sale on Cotton Bureau as we record this tomorrow, July 21st. It'll probably be up for a couple of weeks because that's what they do. And there's a code for members to save 10% off of it as a thank you for being a member. And that code is will be, first off, I'll say the Six Colors magazine should be coming out in the next day or so, and it'll be in there too. Or you can write it down now if you don't want to look in the Six Colors magazine.
Grab a pen and paper.
And it's Six Colors 10, but of course it's more complicated than that because it's SIXCOLORS 10.
Ooh,
that's the code for 10% off the Six Colors t-shirt when it goes on sale at Cotton Bureau in the next day or so. So
I want all our listener members to know this is news to me as I sit here.
Yes. Well, so what happened is that they showed that they could do a Six Color shirt when they did the rainbow for ATP. And so it's actually going to be way more expensive, like $5 more expensive than most of the incomparable shirts we've done that have tended to be one color.
I was going to ask how many colors are in the Six Colors t-shirt.
It's the 6C logo, the you know, the six that's also a C. And it's in the Apple rainbow. So that's the, you know, or the, you know, a non Apple related series of six colors that look exactly like the classic Apple rainbow logo.
Coinkydink.
So anyway, that's what it is. And, six process colors is a tricky thing. So, hopefully it will all be great. But it is a little more pricey. The Cotton Bureau does great work. The ATP shirts look great. It's all going to be good, but, it's a little more pricey because you gotta do every color you add and every side of the shirt you do. It's the same reason why we don't put as many like cute things on the back side of the t-shirt anymore. It's because it's like that increases the cost. Everything increases the cost. So
yeah, but printing on four sides of your shirt is just
there is a company that does that. It's called Print All Around Me, and they can print all on the entire surface of the t-shirt, and it is super strange.
I thought
what if I did a t-shirt that was the Apple rainbow just up the shirt, and then I did a preview of it and I was like, oh no.
It's funny. I run into this when I run my local Frisbee team because we have jerseys printed every few years. And one of the things that has gotten quite hip in the Frisbee scene for like uniform shirts is the dye sublimation. It's not even like, it's crazy. Like it's not printed on so much as it's like just dyed in the fabric.
Yeah, it's like a tie-dye, except instead of that, it's like the dice-up printer just injects dye into the fabric, and then that's it.
They look great, and you can do all sorts of crazy stuff with that you can't do with just sort of your traditional screen printing. But they also I think, believe, tend to be a little pricier.
Yeah.
But they're good for, especially because we get the shirts that are like the like sweat wicking, you know, like jersey shirts rather than like cotton shirts.
Right.
So that adds some price too. But yeah, I've been through all these shirt printing things.
So 6 colors, 10 for 10% off, and it'll be up soon. And yeah, look for that in the magazine too. So that's my little pick. So it's funny, it came up on Clockwise today, something that I also am writing about that'll be in the magazine, which is about Swift Playgrounds, because I've been playing with the Swift Playgrounds, and they're great. They're legitimately great. However, I will say, when I was playing with the Beta 1, the developer beta of iOS 10, I got to a point where I had to stop because there was a bug in the lesson that I was doing, and I wrote it, and I checked and checked, and I know I did it correctly, and it wouldn't proceed. And it was very clearly a bug that I believe I saw that they had fixed. But that was a kind of funny moment. It's like, it is beta. Lessons are beta too. It's great. They're so good. And as a person who did programming in school, I and still kind of hack around with stupid scripts and stuff on my Mac. To use Swift, which is I think a very clear language. I coming as a non-programmer, I look at it and think, oh, you know, this makes sense to me. The way that it handles conditionals and loops and things like that, it seems perfectly reasonable. And it also seems like, to introduce these concepts to kids, the lessons do such a great job of it. So I've been really getting into the Swift Playground stuff. I need to, now that there's a new beta, I need to get back and best that lesson that defeated me. But it's so good.
I haven't had a chance to play around with it at all because I only have the iOS beta installed on a phone right now.
Right, and you can't, it's iPad
and you
only.
You can't run it, yeah. So, but I'm intrigued from what I saw in the keynote and what I've heard from other people. I enjoy programming sometimes. mostly my background's in web programming, which I always have found a little bit easier to grok because it's like, you know, throwing up a web page with a script on it is in some ways a little less imposing than trying to create an entire app. I have trouble with AppleScript, which I know you really like, because I just, something about that syntax, I have such a hard time.
Do I really like it? I don't know if I would say I really like it.
You use it. You are very experienced with it, and you manage to make it do things that I sit down and try to figure it out, and I give up like after about half an hour to an hour of like banging my head against the wall.
Yeah, it's I'm not sure I would say I enjoy AppleScript or like it, but I do use it because I know enough to be dangerous. One of the nice things about AppleScript, there's a lot of examples on the internet. And so I you know, through the years, I just kind of like pick up routines here and there and slap things together and all of that. And that's always been my story with AppleScript. And so I wouldn't say that I like it or ever really feel comfortable with it, but I know enough of it to get, and there's some stuff. Although even today in the Relay FM Slack, we were talking, I asked for help about something that I know I can do with an AppleScript, but I'd really rather not do with an AppleScript, which is, you know, basically have a thing where if I press a keystroke or click a button, a couple of Finder windows will get spawned in, you know, in exactly the right place with the exact set to the right folder. And I know how to do that with AppleScript, but I just don't want to go through it. And I was asking if there was any like utility that anybody could think of that would just do that easily. And it looks like Keyboard Maestro will probably do it for me. And I use Keyboard Maestro, and I'm as soon as Shahid mentioned that, I was like, oh yeah, yeah, it totally can do that. So that's probably where I'm gonna end up. And that's my relationship to AppleScript in a nutshell, which is I can do it if I need to do it. But if I can avoid it, I'd rather avoid it because it's not it's not that fun. And it is, you know, this is the Swift is an attempt to have something that's really understandable and readable. AppleScript was an attempt to have it be like writing sentences. The problem with that is
that doesn't really work.
It gets really convoluted because there are times when you have to write sentences that start out seeming like human sentences and then rapidly become like nonsense, and you almost want to abstract it a level. It's like it's an uncanny valley kind of situation where they're so word like and sentence like that you apply your human, you know, sentence brain to it, and it makes no sense.
I think that's exactly the problem, because my human sentence brain and my human programming brain, I have just enough experience. Oh yeah, I have just enough programming to be dangerous. So I put that together with like the fact that I write and edit stuff every day, and it doesn't quite, those two halves of the brain want to fight over understanding the syntax of AppleScript.
Yeah.
I think that's a problem for me.
Because it's not really readable. It acts like it is, but it's not. And so something like Swift, or JavaScript, or, you know, any kind of more traditional programming language, that's the advantage it has. Now, one of the things I hate about a lot of programming languages is that they are so, There are a lot of classic programming languages that have really shortened terms. Then you're like, what am I seeing there? Or everything gets nested in like brackets and parentheses and things, sure, where it makes it very hard to read it. But I can say my experience so far, they're being gentle in Swift playgrounds. Like I don't see anything in the Swift code that I've been doing in the Swift playgrounds that I would say seems unreasonable or not understandable. And that's, some of that is that's a good lesson you're learning syntax as you go, so that then when you look back at it, you're like, oh, I understand what I'm seeing there. And that's, that's better, than a lot of AppleScript stuff where you look at it and you're like, I have no idea. Even if it's stuff that I'm using in my scripts, where I'll say, I have no idea what this actually does or why it's phrased the way it is. It's just, that's the way that worked. So that's the way it's set.
The benefit of Swift is also that they have obviously had, they have a lot of stuff to look at, right? Like they have a lot of history to look at and say, okay, this works here, this works here, this doesn't work here. Mm-hmm. And sort of rather than like bolting on to an existing language, they have the ability to sort of wipe the slate clean and say, we're going to start over and try. I mean, like, and everybody likes that idea. It doesn't always work out, right? Because you build up cruft over time and you add more stuff
you do Swift, right? That's right. It's just to that. And learn from Ruby and Python and Perl and just like learn from everything that's come before, the higher level scripting languages, the more deep down like the C languages and all of that, and then come out with something that is Apple sort of like fresh start.
20 years from now they might need to totally start all over again, but you know, for now this seems like it's a really interesting exercise. The thing that always interested me in college, and I knew a lot of computer science folks, was that the stuff that they teach on is almost never the stuff that you use. There are a variety of languages that get used a lot in CS classes, and almost none of them are things that are used in production environments. So I'm thinking of, I think there's a language called Schema, which is very popular in schools, but is not a thing that's really used in most places. I mentioned earlier today, Clockwise, Pascal is another one that gets used in teaching in some places, and not really a language that gets used in production anywhere. Because there are languages that are good for teaching because they're organized in ways that make it easy for you to sort of construct thoughts.
Right.
But are not necessarily designed to be deployed in a way where, you know, in an environment where performance or cross-platform or all that stuff is as important. So Swift seems like an interesting way to try and hedge those bets. Yeah, it's got a lot of those high-level sort of philosophical, like, yeah, let's make this clear, let's make it easy, let's learn from everything. But it also is something designed to, you know, do the work, right? It's designed to do the lifting and actually be a production language. So that's it's an interesting approach. I'm not enough of a programmer to say whether it works or not, but I've heard some... I feel like I've heard people enthused about it in some places, also noting shortcomings in others. But mm-hmm. you know, that's it's an interesting idea, and I'm looking forward to playing around with Playgrounds.
Yeah, I'm committed to going through all the lessons, and that's exciting to me. Like to do that because I want to. I'm not going to teach myself Objective-C.
Right. Yeah. So I thought about it once or twice, and then I was like, no, I got better.
But Swift, I want to go through at least these lessons. I mean, and the lessons I'm stepping through now are teaching very beginner concepts, but it's useful for the terminology, at least for me. Like, oh, it's a conditional. Yeah. Okay. But still, I want to step through that process and see what it's like, and it's sort of teaching me the terminology along the way, which is a lot of fun. And you know, and maybe I can apply it someday somewhere. I'm eclectic like that. I mean, generally, if I need if I need a solution to a problem, like I've got a bunch of scripts that invoke shell scripts now that were based on stuff that I got from Marco Arment. Because when mm-hmm. I bodge things together, it's an Apple script. And when Marco bodges things together, it's in shell scripts. Right. And so I bought like the O'Reilly book about shell scripting because I realized I don't know enough about it. Even though I've been bodging together shell scripts occasionally myself since I was in college, I really never took the time to learn anything about it. I just sort of tried to intuit it all. And I finally was like, all right, I'm going to learn more about this. And because Marco's scripts do things not quite the way I want them because they were built for him. And then he was nice enough to say, here are my scripts, but they don't do what I need them to do. And I don't know enough to change them. So it's one of those things where I realized, yeah, I just need to learn this. And that's the way it works for me is on, not abstractly like, oh, I should learn this. But it's more like, I need to solve a problem. And so I'm going to learn this thing. And I mean, I learned AppleScript to solve problems of welding together. Like back when I did Intertext, the internet fiction magazine that I did in the like 90s, I had my mailing list was in FileMaker and I sent it out with an AppleScript where it would make messages in Eudora from FileMaker records. I mean, stuff like that. It's like I needed a way to process submissions. I needed a way to process email bounces. And eventually somebody wrote a product that did that and I used that instead. But for a while there, this was like, I have a product that does half of this job and another product that does the other half. And there's this AppleScript thing that welds them together. So I guess I'll do that. And I had a purpose, and that's why I did the AppleScript. That was the to solve a problem. And so, you know, shell scripting, it's to solve a problem. And with Swift, you know, it's more like I want to explore this new thing. Hopefully I could use it to solve some problems later, but I don't know.
Yeah. No, I agree. I set out trying to shell script stuff too, and I just never spent enough time. This much as the time I spent in the command line, I just never spent a lot of time doing scripting there. So, not my strong suit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's pretty great. I mean, one of the things about it pays to know a professional computer programmer is also on the side doing a thing that you're also doing, because what happens is Marco builds tools for himself and then to the rest of us is like, oh yeah, you want to use this too? And I have weird command line apps and shell scripts. I have stuff that he did in shell scripting and then I wrapped it in like an automator action so that it's a service so that I can just like use a keyboard shortcut in the finder to do it. But I have a lot of this stuff that just kind of comes from the fact that Marco wanted to scratch his own itch. And I was like, hey, I also have that itch. And he's like, yeah, sure. Here, use the scratcher. And everybody wins, right? Although some of this stuff is like not public, which is infuriating because people say, Jason, how do you sync up all your audio tracks? And I can't tell you. But some of it is public. And like he finally did his one app. I am hopeful that he's going to do some more public releases at some point. But boy, that is awfully nice because I've gone a long way on Marco's knowledge of shell scripting. And that's great. That's really great. Like my encoding a generic MP3 that I need to get for a podcast out of a WAV file, I can like do a keyboard shortcut in the finder and it encodes it all. And that's just, you know, I'm adapting a shell script that Marco wrote. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's funny because I've ended up with this whole long process for that, which I tried to adapt some of the stuff that both you and Marco had written. And I get like halfway into it, and I'm like, ugh.
I know, right? That's why I bought that. That's why I bought that O'Reilly book about shell scripting. Is like I tried to deconstruct one of his things, and it was like, I have a shell script that you have to change the directory in the command line to be in this folder, and then you run the script and it compresses a bunch of stuff in the folder, and it's great. It's like it's a nice little thing, and it's using just stock tools, but it's something that Marco whipped up that is very specific to some Logic audio projects. It's great. It's just a shortcut, but I tried to wrap that into an automator action and it just doesn't work. Just like literally, it thinks when it's inside, when it's executing inside the automator action, it thinks that it's, it doesn't know what folder it's supposed to be acting inside of. And I can't figure out how to do it. And I was like, all right, I guess I'm going to have to teach myself how to do shell scripting so I can figure this out. And it's just, it's stuff like that where you end up throwing up your hands and go, well, in the meantime, I guess I'm just going to open the terminal and change to that directory and then run the script because that's all I, you know, that's all I can do. That's when you hit the wall.
Right. Yeah. It makes it a lot harder.
John Syracuse was giving me grief because my hard drive is called Macintosh HD. I didn't customize name it. I my Mac has a name, but my hard drive doesn't have a name. He said, oh, you should give that a name. And I said, John, actually, at this point, I can't because I have too many scripts that are going all the way up to Macintosh HD. And if I change it, this just happened. I lost my transmit shortcuts, the FTP app transmit, and I was able to kind of like pull them out of the history. And then I tried to run my script that uploads images to six colors and it failed. And I realized, oh, I named the shortcut, the favorite in transmit, something that wasn't the name that was hard coded in the scripts.
Yes.
So I had to change it back.
I did some tweaking when you gave me the six colors, the script that we used to upload images to six colors, to address the fact that, yeah, this is, I mean, weird sort of laziness is like, oh, it's much easier for me to change your script than it is for me to change my favorite.
Yeah.
I don't think that's true, actually. No. I think it's probably roughly equivalent, but I decided I wanted it my way.
Yeah. I had the old script was looking for a thing called six colors, one word, lowercase. And when I made the new ones, I decided to properly like space and capitalize them.
So I
went back to the scripts and I changed them all to, you know, connect to favorite six colors instead of favorite six colors. And I had added like three scripts to do that, but I decided I would do that rather than just, I didn't want to be the monkey to those scripts and like, oh, the scripts are making me change this to a stupid name. I decided, no, scripts, take this. I'm going to make you change instead. And it was,
Jason,
more work for me. But
don't listen when the scripts tell you to do things. That way was madness.
No, the scripts. I just do what the scripts tell me, Dan.
We're going off script.
Do I write the scripts or do the scripts write me?
Wow. You need a...
I write the scripts,
Dan.
Step
back. Yeah, you
I write the
back.
Scripts that make the whole world sing.
The Six Colors musical coming soon.
That was an old music reference. You know that one? That was a Barry Manilow. Yeah. My parents didn't buy a lot of popular music in the 70s, but they had an 8-track player, and they had quite a collection of terrible 8-tracks. And there may have been a Barry Manilow in there.
We never have 8-tracks, but we do have a record player, which my dad still to this day uses sometimes, with mostly an extensive variety of classical music. But there are some, I flipped through at one point, there are some Beatles LPs in there. And I flipped through at one point and found some other pop songs from the 70s. I think my mom had like a Cat Stevens 1970s record or something.
Yeah, we had that. My brother had Elton John, which in hindsight I was like, oh yeah, that's cool. But my parents were just like, I mean, yeah. Kenny Rogers. Sigh. Anyway. No offense to Kenny Rogers. Your chicken is great. So, what else?
Kenny Rogers, noted listener member.
Yes. Sorry. Listener member. Hyphenate. He is a hyphenate. He's a listener member singer songwriter.
Too many hyphens.
What else, Dan? Anything else going on?
You already mentioned that we're doing the magazine.
Yeah.
Which is exciting. I assume people.
I wonder what
exciting.
I wonder what your wacky, zany back page column will be this time because you haven't written
it
yet.
I haven't written it yet. It's always my columns and I have this relationship where I think I should get a head start on them this week.
And then
say,
I find myself
like with like an hour to go before deadline thinking, oh my God, I've got to write something. And yeah, so the inspiration for those doesn't come easy necessarily. So that will be, we'll see what that ends up being. We did write a bunch about, we talked a bit about Scrivener last week. It's out today.
It is out.
That's exciting.
And I've seen some people write about it. What's funny to me is that some people have seen people get like us get excited about it who don't use it on the Mac or the PC and then get the iOS version and be excited by it, which is not – that's great to hear. it's not a perspective that I can have at all, right? For me, it's all about being a bridge to from a continuity bridge from the desktop. And so, you know, it's hard for me to even kind of connect those things. And so I evaluated it very much on this of like, yes, I can do this on iOS now, and not what if I was Federico Vitici, and who he talked about that on the Connected 100. I almost said the prompt. Wow. Connected number 100 this week, that he's using it, I think, to organize his iOS review.
Yeah.
And that's fascinating because he doesn't use Scrivener on the Mac and never has, but thinks it might be a good way to do long document stuff on iOS. So maybe so. And certainly he'll find out one way or another, and maybe he'll say nope in the end. But
yeah, I'm fascinated by that as well, because especially because it does handle long form in a way that I feel like many other editors don't necessarily, right? Like the idea of grouping a bunch of different things together in a project. I don't know. I've used other text editors, but a lot of them are sort of more file-based, right? Like, it's like, okay, I have a file. I write a thing in that file. I save that file, and I move on. And it's not that you can't create a folder with a bunch of files in it. Obviously, you can. But Scrivener actually turns that into a object that has some sort of properties to it, right? It is a project that has a bunch of things in it. So I don't think I would... I've never really used Scrivener to write anything that was not fiction. So it's harder for me to wrap my head around.
So what I did when Federico was talking about this is I sent him a screenshot of the Mac version, but with my like Mountain Lion review or something, because I wrote several OS X, long OS X reviews in Scrivener. And he saw that and he was like, oh yeah. And you know, it's like I got the reviewer's guide in there, and I got a bunch of notes, and I got, you know, and I got all my sections and all of that. And I think for him, that was that moment where he realized, oh, this is applicable. Now, like Andy Anatko will do, he writes a lot in Scrivener, and he'll do things like if he's writing, like when he was writing a monthly column for Macworld, he had a Scrivener document for Macworld and it had all his columns in it, which I thought was an interesting approach. But, you know, it is an organizational tool. You can have multiple stories basically inside a project, and you can have a research bin, and you know, there's lots of different ways that you can structure it. You can slip into outline view, which actually is one of those things that I feel is missing from the iOS version, is a pure like outliner view, which I really like in the Mac version. And in iOS, you kind of always have the editor window open like you're writing, and right. I like the outliner view. Maybe that will come down the road. It's kind of amazing. It's got all the features it has for a 1.0, but that's the one I miss, is sort of like popping all the way back out into the outline and just dragging around my outline and adding little notes in my outline, and it kind of doesn't work like that right now.
Yeah, as someone who is not at all really an outliner, that is something I never really delve into. So it did not occur to me that that was a feature not present in the iOS version, but now that you mention it, I think, oh, that's true. There's a lot in there that's not something that's really handled as well on the iOS version as it is on the Mac. But I can also understand why that would not necessarily be the top priority for the 1.0, and I'm interested to see if they decide to bring that over.
Yeah. I don't know. That's what hooked me on Scrivener, honestly, was that outliner. The fact that I could write in it and it was also the outliner.
Yeah, I you know, it's funky when you look at other people's stuff. It's like, you know, I think maybe Lex Fridman, I think he was the person I thought about saying, or who I attribute this quote to. I'm not sure if he originated or not, was the like other people's iPhones are hell. Basically, yeah. Picking up someone's phone or computer and being like, why do you have all these things in weird places, right? And so I think similarly, writers looking at each other's like Scriveners or other documents are like, wait, why do you do it? Because I see like writers who actually do use the lowest level in Scrivener to do like scenes. And then scenes are grouped into folders that are chapters.
Wow.
And then the chapters are in like a folder that's the project. And I think to myself, that seems crazy to me.
Yeah.
But I know a lot of people who do it. And well, again, I'm not making a judgment call there.
You.
I just like, it's puzzling to me.
Well, welcome to the Writing Nerd Podcast, which, believe it or not, is a podcast we've talked about doing and one day we'll probably do. But I think if I was writing a book where every chapter had multiple viewpoints or scene shifts in it, right, I would probably do it that way. But I don't think I would do that because, like, because I have a book. The book that I'm rewriting now is three viewpoint characters, and they alternate. Literally, it's just 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 for the whole book until they meet later. Spoilers. not. So maybe I'll just change that part. So my point is, everyone is its own chapter. But I could see a structure where you're like, well, really, this chapter is these three different bits. And at one point, I actually thought about taking my viewpoint characters' chapters and splitting them up. I think I did this at one point in Scrivener and putting them in their own folders because I wanted to kind of like go through them person mm-hmm. by person instead of interlaced. And you can do that, which is nice. But yeah, it's one of the great things about Scrivener and a lot of good software is you don't use most of the features. Everybody uses 10% of the features, but everybody uses a different 10%, and it works because it's flexible and it lets you use whatever 10% you want.
Right, which is, I mean, thinking about that, my first book has multiple viewpoint characters, and in one of my Scrivener projects, I decided to put colored labels in the chapter view or the like little outliner on yep. the left hand, the binder, sorry, for which character was narrating a given chapter.
Yeah, that my book's like that.
And it was interesting for me is it's not like, it's like alternate, alternate, double, alternate, double, alternate. This one has both people. And then the last three chapters are like all of them. I had to come right. up with another color because like all three of them switch like within the chapter back and forth between two characters.
Yeah, well,
so,
you know.
Yeah, no organization plan survives contact with the enemy.
That's true. That's true. But it is useful for me. Yeah, so my binder has a viewpoint character and what its draft status is because I'm doing a rewrite. So I've got chapters marked as first draft and chapters marked as rewrite. And that's useful too because I can see what's left to do. What do I need to do next? And I'm trying to go through linearly, but there may be chapters where I'm like, I can't do this right now, and I jump ahead or I make a change that requires another change, and I follow that thread for a while, and then I can go back. Anyway, it's cool if you write long form stuff. Whether it's I've also heard from people since we wrote that story last week who do like their PhD dissertations
oh, sure,
with Scrivener
yeah.
because it's got this huge like I said research kind of bin where you can just put notes and images and web pages and PDFs and stuff, and I've got there was a scene in my book where there was a character is dressed up to go out for dinner, and I went on a website and basically picked a dress for her to wear and mm-hmm. took a screenshot of it so that I could use it for reference later if I needed to describe it in a certain way or refer back to it. And I just threw it in the bin. It's like I took a screenshot of the webpage and threw it in the bin.
Yeah, there's a novel template that Scrivener has, and one of the entries for it is a folder of characters, like to like keep your bios and stuff. And that currently for me, for my most recent draft, has pictures of actors who are how I envision those characters, which is handy, again, to have something to refer to and be like, okay, well, who is this character? What do they look like? Like, let's remember that, like, not to like constantly change their eye color, you know, from one chapter to the next chapter. Or if I decided to change their eye color from the person that it's roughly based, their appearance might be like roughly based on, at least note that in that file so that I can like refer back to it later. It's like, I mean, years ago I used, and I don't believe he develops anymore. I think he sold it, but Gus Mueller's Voodoo Pad, which was essentially an app for building like your own personal wiki. And I used that for building out a lot of universe stuff. And I sadly lost a couple of those files in a data loss incident. But it was really handy because it was like creating a little wiki. You had little hyperlinks. You'd be like, okay, this character goes here. They're related to this character. You click on them to go here. And I really enjoyed having that hyperlink capability where I could jump around and sort of remember like, okay, you know, what are the names of this character's kids? Or how did those two characters meet or what have you? Like, just in case you need to look something up. You know, it's handy because, you know, it's weird how much more readers remember that kind of thing than writers do sometimes. Cause I will definitely have people like, oh yeah, remember where this thing happened? And I'd be like, oh my God, what? I have to look now. I have to go up and look that up in my own book. It's hard to remember things sometimes.
All right. Well, we should call it for now. I'm going to be traveling next week, but the plan is that, I'm still doing Clockwise next week, so I will also try to do this. We're going to Southern California for my wife's parents live there, and so we're going to go visit them and leave the kids with them for like a week and a half. And it's going to be I'm an independent worker now, right? So I'll have my stuff in the internet and we'll probably be working less, but still working next week. But I'm definitely around, and we'll also do probably like before or after Clockwise is my guess. We'll do another little secret podcast from where I'll be remote. Secret location.
Secret location. Undisclosed.
And, yeah. We'll work it out. It's summer, so you know, there may be weeks where I'm not here, Dan's not here, there's no podcast here, something like that. But we'll it happens. We'll work it out.
We're allowed. We're not chained to these desks.
No. That's a nice thing. That's why I left the old job.
I'm contractually obliged to say I'm not chained to this desk. Please send help.
Yeah, they brought the chains in, and I was like, nope. That was that. All right. Well, thanks to everybody out there for subscribing. Look for the Six Colors magazine if you're in your inbox in the next couple of days. Don't forget, SixColors10 is the code, SIXCOLORS10, for 10% off the Six Colors t-shirt because you are a member. And that's it. Bye, Dan.
Bye, Jason.